Tim, welcome.
Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. You may begin.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. This is the PDNR call on the 25th of January. And on the call, we have Tatiana Kramsova, Siva Mutisami, Cheryl Langdonor, Michele Nilon, Jeffrey Eckhouse, Ron Wickersham, Alan Greenberg, Ollie Hope, Barry Cobb, James Bledel, Mason Cole, and for staff, we have Marika Koenig, Tim Cole, and myself, Glenda Saint-Jerry. May I ask you all to say your name before you speak for transcription purposes? Thank you very much, and over to you, Alan.
Thank you very much, Glenn. All right, we've got, I'm told, three more meetings after this one if we are to make our deadline of a final report in time for the publication deadline for San Francisco. I think our intention is to still try to do that. We had originally said that we wanted all comments in by preferably last Friday, although Marika was willing to take them until Sunday. We have gotten only a very few, Oliver Hope and myself. And based on a comment that Mason made earlier today, I suspect there are still more changes coming. If that is indeed the case, then I would suggest we not spend time today reviewing the document just to have to go over it again. But could we take a quick poll of who plans to actually submit comments on the report, on the draft report, on the sections that are already written, that is? If there are still significant ones who are planning to. Jeff?
I just had a question on that, Alan. I mean, I really didn't have many questions on the final report, but more on the recommendations. And I know those are being sent out separately. So are you when you say final report, do you mean including the recommendations
That's why I said on the parts of the final report that are already written. The recommendations are hopefully being written as we speak, but are certainly not in that report.
So, okay, yeah, because I think that was, to me, that was the main difference on that. I just wanted to be clear on that. For myself, I don't think I have much on the actual draft report, but I do have some on the recommendations, which I think we're going to go over today. So that was input.
Then I would suggest, Mason, you said you still have some, and I suspect there may be a few others. I would suggest starting with the recommendations right now, and if we have time, we'll go back starting on the report, but I suspect we won't, and defer the report itself until probably next week. And so this is sort of a last drop-dead chance. If people still want to review it, we can take more at this point, but not much after that. Marika.
Yeah, this is Marika. You're not wanting to go into the detailed report, but one thing we might want to discuss to make sure as well people focus on the right parts is to assess whether people feel comfortable moving the whole background section into the annex, or maybe not even include it, but just refer to it by link, noting that further information was included in the initial report on the background on the issue and the actual content of the issue report. And I noted that some people had comments on some of the content there. And as I suggested in the previous email, it might be more appropriate to include that actually in the part on the working group deliberations so that it's more linked to what the working group discussed instead of trying to rewrite what is actually in the issue report, even if people feel that it was not accurate or certain things were missing, but maybe it's better to capture that in that part. Another suggestion might be because we get a lot of comments from people that reports are too long, there's too much information. Another suggestion might be to move the information on the working group survey also to either an annex or just include it by reference to the initial report, because that's a part as well that I think serves as a good background from where the group has come and where we've gone, but it might not be as relevant to include it in this version of the report. So just some ideas and suggestions.
Yeah, I'll put my stake in the ground, but then open it up to other people's comments. I would recommend putting as much as possible in annexes. And in some cases, and the survey is one that, Ilo, I haven't thought about carefully, that we might want to try to summarize what the answers are, but without going into any great detail. I strongly support putting them in annexes and not just pointing to them, because the strength of that is if someone downloads the annexes or the whole report, if they choose to, they have everything with them, and they don't suddenly find out that there's a salient part of the report that they don't have. And perhaps, you know, an awful lot of people read things on planes, if nothing else. And so I think it's useful to replicate the documents, such as the issues report, but do it in an annex and following the methodology that was used in new GTLDs, I'd make it a separate downloadable document. The more we can make the basic document a short document, the more people are actually likely to read it. You know, if you download a 150-page document, some people won't open it up at all. So my inclination is to make the basic document as short as possible and include anything else that we want people to be able to look at in annexes. How do other people feel about that? One tick, two ticks, no hand clapping, no X's. I'm assuming everyone else can live with it if we don't hear otherwise. If you have strong feelings on it, please let us know on the mailing list very soon. But that's certainly the way I would like to see GNSO reports going in general. We've had the awkward case in recent history of the GNSO people, of GNSO approving reports, and apparently not reading all of them. And I think that's not where direction we want to go in.
Yes, this is Ron Wickersham.
Sure, Ron.
Starting last week, well, I wanted to check off agreeing with making the core report small. I think that's an excellent, useful thing to do. But the issue I'm having was last week when I tried to come to the meeting, they had updated the Adobe software, so it wouldn't work on my regular Unix workstation. But because there wasn't a meeting last week, I had plenty of time to mess around getting another portable machine up here, which I was able to get on. Because it says it's the right version of Adobe. But today, I'm not joining you. So I was wondering if everybody else is doing okay with Adobe, but I get Adobe Connect and a blue bar that goes across the screen, and then that's all. It doesn't bring up. Is everyone else working okay with the new version of Adobe?
You seem to have most people who are on the telephone list also on Adobe. If anyone else is having a problem, speak up, but I think you're the only one who's missing. Although I may have missed someone.
Yeah, okay, sorry.
Yes, Marika, I'll put you in touch with one of our IT people that should be able to help, or at least identify whether, you know, your machine should be compatible with Adobe or whether there's another issue. So I'll get them in touch with you, so hopefully it can get sorted for the next call.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Marika. All right. Marika, anything else to discuss about the report itself, or should we go on to recommendations?
This Marika, nothing further from my side.
Then if you could put the recommendations up.
Give me a second.
Now, with few exceptions, the ones that I have formatted as recommendations, there's still other ones to come at this point, are ones that had a good degree of consensus, perhaps complete consensus, within the telephone calls where they were discussed. And the prime thing I did is try to reword them so that they are more formal if they weren't, and to use the terminology that is used within the RAA, as opposed to the terminology which we've tended to use within this this working group. And examples of that, instead of domain name, it's the registered name. The registrant is the registered name holder and things like that, which are all defined terms within the RAA. The order of these items is the order in which I did them. Clearly, once we finish, they're going to have to be reordered so that they are cohesive and hold together. Any general comments or thoughts before we start looking at them in specific? Jeff.
Yeah, sorry. I think, and this was something actually that was in the draft of the report. Do you think that you believe we have consensus on these recommendations? Because I just don't remember like a vote being taken and a tally or that posted to the. I know I missed the call, so I'm sorry if you guys took a vote on that call, but I don't know if that's what you mean by consensus of the group.
If you go look at the proposal documents. And there's one which we've been using for the last number of, actually months, I guess, or several weeks, where we've been talking about the various proposals that both James submitted and I submitted. Each of them is flagged with the date and the outcome. So in most cases there was consensus. Now, we're not claiming that's a work group consensus. That was consensus of the people on the call.
Okay, yeah, because I was confused, and I would very much hesitate to call it consensus because right. You could say, because that makes it seem like, that word has so many, you know, cautions around it, but just to say, because then it would seem exclusionary in some other piece. I would say if we can just say, like, some other word saying, of the people on the call on that date or something like that, because I think
that is what I said in the email. I said it was consensus of the people on the call when it was discussed. If that's not clear, we'll make it clear.
Yeah, it wasn't because in the draft report it just said consensus. That's why I was a little confused.
In the draft report,
the final report. Sorry.
Well, but that doesn't have the recommendations in it yet.
I thought it did.
No. There was a version that I accidentally sent on Sunday. That had some recommendations, but those were ones that Marika had sort of created as a starting discussion, but we never looked at those at all.
Oh, you know what? That's what I was looking at, actually. That was the exact one.
Yeah, no, that was a red herring, and my apologies for sending that out.
Okay, that's why I was confused. There you go.
We drafted at one point, but decided to reach consensus, reach agreement on the work group before we cast it in concrete in the report, and that report shouldn't have seen the light of day, and I sent it by mistake.
Okay, no, that clears it up perfect. Thanks.
Whatever will go on the report, we'll meet the consensus rules, whatever we decide, and one of the things we must decide today before we finish is, are we doing a formal survey, or are we using an email methodology where, essentially, if people don't respond, they're deemed to have accepted it, or some combination of them. Marika says it was a document that went out onto the mailing list a number of times, but it was never adopted by this group. So, all right. First one is, and it's one that came from originally from the Proposal 7, if you want to go back and look at the history of when we discussed it and such, you can use that column. The wording is, all unsponsored GTLD registers shall offer the redemption grace period for currently existing GTLDs that do not currently offer the RGP. A transition period shall be allowed. All new GTLDs must offer the RGP. And there is a comment there, or an intent added by Ron, of converge to consistent policy for all GTLDs to aid education policy. Now, I wasn't quite sure whether indeed we needed an exception. When Michael Young first had this reviewed by the registries, there was a need for exception. I believe it was only sponsored GTLDs, Michael has not made a specific comment on this one, so I'm assuming he's accepting it as not needing a specific exception. We'll get positive confirmation from him, but I believe the item the text under for discussion can be removed at this point, but we'll check with Michael. Any comments on this? No? Okay. The next one is to define original registered name holder. Now, this is the term that we were using, RAE, the registrant at time of expiration. We need to use terminology that's consistent with the RAE, with the RAA, and I came up somewhat arbitrarily with original name holder. Ron added the comment that he doesn't like the terminology, but I think we're stuck with the terminology registered name holder. That's cast in concrete in the RAA. And he was worried about the term original, implying that this may have been the original one 4 years ago, but not the one at time of expiration. I think that's covered by simply defining it as the name holder of record at just prior to expiration. But comments, James?
Yeah, I just wanted to lend my support to Ron's concern. When I hear original registered name holder, I think origin, and I think of when the name was first registered, which could have gone back to, you know, in the case of Mr. O'Connor, could have gone back into the 90s or late 80s. So I think that we need to find a better term there, most recent registered name holder, or we do have to find a term, and I don't want it to be too unwieldy, but original is probably
we're already up to a minimum 4 words. I prefer to keep it not any higher than that.
Yeah. Now, and it's a mouthful, but registered name holder at expiry, which would be RNHAE. I don't know. It's just my swing at it, but I agree with Ron. Original is problematic.
Okay. I have no problem with that, especially if we use a convention that we abbreviate things. The RAA doesn't tend to have abbreviations like that, but I have no problem. Registered name holder at expiration and defined to be the name holder just prior to expiration, I have no problem with that. Is that agreeable to everyone? Obviously, if we come up with a better word until it can be changed, and in fact, what we put in our report is when the legal folks get involved in actually changing the text of the RAA, they can come up with a better term at that point. Nothing we're putting in is cast in concrete in terms of terminology. So I'm happy to change all the references to registered name holder at expiration. Agreed? James?
Quick question. You said something about changing the language in the RAA, and you lost me on that.
Oh, no, I'm... When did I say that? Just right now or initially?
Yeah, you said that when ICANN Legal works on this to get the language changed for the RAA,
Well, any consensus policy effectively is a change to the RAA.
Right, but it doesn't go into the RAA. The RAA just points to...
Well,
okay.
Except for the EDDP, it did get integrated next time around. So, I'm not trying to alter how these things are done. I'm just trying to craft something that will be understandable, and there will not be any mistake in what we mean. So, yes, when I say change the RAA, I mean create policies which will ultimately modify the RAA or perhaps even get rolled in some later revision. Okay. I think we're done with number two. All right. Three is... the provision that says the registrar must essentially offer the RGP for domains that are deleted on a GTLD that supports that offers the RGP. Michael has added some terminology at the beginning. Well, my original comment was a registrar, if a registrar deletes a registered name that the and that registered name enters the RGP, the registrar must allow the original registered name holder, obviously now changed, to redeem the registered name. He clarified it at the beginning. He says following expiration during the auto-renew grace period. No problem with that in my mind. And then he added a clause afterwards which essentially says, in short, that a change in the records of the registrar and who is record should not impact the ability of that registrant to exercise their RGP rights. Michael is not on the call right now, but I have talked to him about this in some detail, so if there's a question of what he meant or why he put it, I might be able to address it if anyone is questioning the language that he's added. Okay, the terminology at the end of separate unilateral action means that the agreement of a registrant in the registration agreement to allow reassignment by the or sale by the registrar after expiration is not covered in this particular exclusion. But if the registrant explicitly says, yes, I'm willing to sell this to a third party because I'm going to make a pile of money on it, that obviously that transfer is what is allowing, what is excluded, being excluded here. James.
Yes, Alan, James speaking. And I missed last week, and I've been...
We canceled last week, so you didn't miss.
Okay. Well, I've been playing catch-up on the list, so I am probably a little behind the discussions on this. Separate unilateral action, I think, is a really interesting phrase. I guess my first question is separate from what? And then the second question would be, do we consider the explicit delete of a domain name to be a unilateral action on the part of the registrant?
On the part of the registrant?
Yes. If they explicitly delete the name, it is then what? The registrar no longer has an obligation to offer RGP in that case?
No. The exclusion is aimed at the situation of... I'll try to give the case he was talking about. The name expires. You start an auction process, not irrevocable. Start an auction process. Find out that there's a market for this name, that'll yield you $10,000. You call up the registrant. You say, "Are you willing to part with it? We'll share the money with you." He says, "Hell yes," and it gets transferred to someone. So the registrant at the time of reassignment says, "Yes, I'm willing to do it." That's the case that he is willing to accept. Other ones where the registrant has not taken action at that time, he wants to make sure that the RGP can go through to the original registrant.
So, and forgive me again if I'm...
Again, it's not my language. It's not my language, but it was written on the fly as he was trying to get this to work. So
okay. It
may well need adjustment.
Well, and I mean, I guess my question being that are we then defining the exception scenarios by which the registrant at time of expiry waives their, and I hate the word right, waives their redemption privileges?
Yes.
Okay. I'm probably going to have to just digest this a little bit more.
The version with those words in it came in about 12 minutes before this meeting. And Michael sent a later version after that correcting some typos, which I don't think this is one of. So the intent is essentially, other than in the very much an edge case where the registrant, after expiration, decides they really want to sell it to someone else along with with the help of the registrar, which I think is very much an edge case tail case, that if the name is deleted, the registrant just prior to expiration should be able to exercise the RGP. And I'm assuming Michael is basing this statement on, you know, existing problems they've had exercising RGP rights in the past.
Just one final comment on that,
sure.
And I'll lower my hand.
Yeah.
This is, and I'm not picking on Michael. I know he's not on the call, and I'm sure that he has a very good point here that I'm just not picking up on. But this, in general, is my concern with outlining policies and then exception cases, because, one, I think that registrars become confused over what it, you know, what their clear obligations are. Two, that the registrant becomes confused as to what's going to happen to their name and what options are available to them. And then three, I think from the point of enforcement, ICANN compliance, you know, looks at this and says, you know, where do we go with this? So I want to caution that if we can tighten this up and remove or very clearly delineate what those exception cases are, I think it serves everybody to do that. And again, I'm not picking on Michael's idea. I'm sure it's a good one. I
suspect that this is properly worded closer to the way the EDDP identified under what rights, under what terms the registrar did not have to delete something after 45 days. You know, it gives a list of scenarios, on a UDRP in action, in various other scenarios where you must delete after 45 days does not apply. And I suspect this can be worded in a case in ways similar to that. But again, I'm both taking on Michael's role and a lawyer's role, and I'm not really skilled to do either of those.
And just again, for my benefit, we are only talking about RGP at the registry level. We're not talking about the auto renew or registrar grace periods.
No, we're say that again.
We're only talking about that period after the registrar explicitly deletes the name, and it's in a registry RGP.
That's correct.
Okay, so. Okay.
I think, this whole recommendation number three is talking about the RGP.
Okay, so that's where I get
redemption
confused.
Under an RGP.
That's where I get confused. Because some of the things that we're drawing exceptions for don't typically occur in an RGP.
Well,
I mean,
no,
the name is in an RGP.
His exception would be a case where the registrant agrees to sell it to the guy who wants to pay $10,000 for it, and
but
then it falls through and the registrar ends up deleting it. I mean, this is a real edge case, I think.
Oh, but see, I think that happens. I don't think that is happening at RGP. I think that's happening before it's getting to RGP. If there's somebody out there that wants $10,000 for it or something, I doubt it even gets to the RGP.
Well, no, it won't. But I said if the registrant agrees and then it falls through, and the registrar ends up deleting it, I think is the case he's making. And maybe if he was on the call, he would say, "Hey, maybe it doesn't apply."
I'll drop it.
Well, why don't you? After the call, give Michael a call and see.
I'll reach out to him via
okay.
email because I think
the yellow words are his and they were his concern, and although they may have merit, I don't feel skilled to address them any more than I already have.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Thanks for trying,
McKaylee.
I'm not going to be reaching out to Michael Young, but I would say that if we're going to start discussing. People's suggestions where it's not at all clear what the hell they mean by it, that we really need to defer that until we can get clarification from them.
Okay.
This one here, I'm trying to get my head around it, kind of half getting there, but if it's such a total and utter edge case, then I don't see why the hell we should be putting it in as a recommendation.
Okay. Then may I suggest for this bulk of the paragraph, the clarification at the beginning of three, I think, is fine. At least I don't think, it just makes the language clearer. For the second part, let's defer it until we can get Michael on the call, or until he gives us something that doesn't have as much concern as has been raised over this one. Jeff?
Yeah, sorry. I agree with McKaylee on that, but I'm not going to go into that part because you made a good point there, Alan. Is this, when it says, let's go back to this original name holder, I know we might have a new name for it, but is that, the issue is, what about when there's who is privacy or some sort of proxy on there? Because it's saying it's the original, is that the name holder as it, as defined in the who is? That was in the registrar records. I wasn't clear about that.
Well, as I understand it, if you operate, for instance, if you operate a privacy service, that's really done almost at arm's length. And if Alan Greenberg registers a domain through the secret domain name privacy service, what does Enom's record say? I know Whois will say secret domain privacy service.
Right.
Do all of your records say secret domain privacy service?
For external purposes, yeah. I mean, internally we see it as well, but there are other mechanisms to see it. But I'm not sure what you mean, just to be clear, in arm's length, because there's a contract between the two parties.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. I'm picking up language on the thing. Right now, if I register a name through a privacy service, the only entity I presume, if the privacy service is not you, then the only entity that can change that name is the privacy service. Is that a correct statement?
I don't know if I can answer that because I'm not sure of your question.
Okay.
When you're saying that. But here, the point being
is, if my lawyer operates a privacy service and they register the name with you, all you see is my lawyer's name.
Correct.
You don't see me because that's in a document which you don't have access to.
Correct.
Okay. So in that case, only the privacy service is the registrant of record.
Right. So that's, I just wanted to be, yeah, exactly, that's correct.
What happens if you're operating the privacy service yourself? I'm not an expert on.
What I want to go back to, Alan, is what your point is. So you're saying on this that whoever the registrant of record was, and that would be in the who is, and that would be your lawyer, they're the only one who can go back and get it. You cannot, correct?
Yeah, subject to the normal rules in business that, you know, if I die, my estate can get it, and, you know, if companies get bought, whoever buys the company, and that kind of stuff. There's
right.
A whole bunch of exceptions which handles as a normal quarter, part of normal events.
My whole point on this, Alan, is I'm not saying it should be one way or the other. I just think we need to be clear saying, saying as shown either in the who is or in something, because it's one of those things where we can say, hey, it wasn't there, but it was there. So I just want to clear up any sort of confusion on these. That's what I wanted to say.
Marika, can you capture that in the for discussion box?
The next
version? Yeah. The intent was, if you go back to our original discussions when we discussed this perhaps ad infinitum, is that a change that is made after expiration, that is, the domain is put in the registrar's name or is potentially auctioned off to Joe Blow, that should not change the rights of the original registrant.
Oh, yeah, I'm in agreement with that.
Yeah.
If
you're saying we need to make sure the language is precise, I agree.
Yes, that's what I was saying. That was it.
And so somewhere along the way, before we cast these in concrete, we must make sure that this means what we thought it meant and the implementation doesn't mean something different.
Exactly. That's my biggest concern there. Thanks.
If that's our biggest disagreement, we're doing well.
Well, on that recommendation, we haven't gotten to the next few yet. Couldn't resist. I'm sorry.
And please, if you have specific suggestions on language, make our life easier and suggest them. All right. I think we're on number four. Number four is a generalization of what Michael added on number three. And I, for one, am not 100% sure why we need the special language on number three, but he felt strongly about it, so... you know, in any case, the one I originally wrote is a change in Whois data or other records by the registrar, which is not done at the explicit request of the original registered name holder, must not alter the original registered name holder the ability to renew the registered domain. And Michael added, during the guaranteed renewal period. Jeff.
Yeah, sorry. Is this one I wasn't, my notes here I had were the change of the who is data by the registrar, which is not done. Is that pre or post expiration?
Everything we're talking about is post expiration.
Okay. Again, so
and your point is taken. We may need to say that, but I don't think registrars typically make changes to who is prior to registration, prior to expiration unilaterally, do you?
No, but it said there have been reported cases of such changes contributing. I haven't seen those cases, so I didn't know what those were pertaining to, so I just said I'm not sure what this is. So was it pre or post? So if we could be posted on it.
Post-expiration.
And sorry, my other point is I think that this one's sort of redundant if we clear up the other one, but that's the separate
issue. The other one is talking only about RGP, whereas this is also talking about simple renewal.
Okay, because I wasn't sure about my pre or post. Okay.
You know, and this one is aimed at if you change the who is information on day one and the registrant has 10 days to renew, that change should not stop their ability to renew, even though they're not the registrant of record in the who is. James.
Yep. Thanks, Alan. James speaking. This is another one that I think is a little messy. First off, we're talking about during this proposed guaranteed renewal period or retrieval period or quarantine period, whatever we're calling it, correct?
Yep.
So it's whether it's, you know, 3 days, 5 days, 10 days, whatever.
To be discussed separately.
Yeah, this end day renewal period. So I think that needs to go first rather than hanging off the end of that sentence. That needs to be at the top. Secondly, I think that it could be cleaner, and I know the other registrars are going to throw rocks at me now, but it could be cleaner if it just said, you know, hey, during this period, this is a quarantine period, it's a hands-off period. No changes to who is that aren't explicitly requested by the registrar name holder. In fact, if it's post-expiry, nobody can change it because even they cannot make updates, even the registered name holder cannot make updates to their who is record without renewing it. So I feel like if we're going to call this a guaranteed renewal period and we're going to quarantine it, and some country codes have something like this where it's just completely hands-off, nobody can touch it, nobody can change it, the only thing it can possibly do is renew. So that's just off the cuff, and again, I'm coming at this cold, so I'm just...
Yeah,
I
certainly have no problem with that. When I was drafting these, I was trying to require the minimal changes to registrar's business practices.
Well, but
I have no problem with what you're suggesting. McKinley.
But then following that quarantine period, in my opinion, no restrictions would apply. Now that's
following the quarantine, if that's what we're calling it, you may choose to allow a registrant to renew, but it's not being guaranteed.
Exactly.
But,
and
but
no
saying you may choose to says you may also refuse. So.
Yes.
What you do with a change to is, again, is a business practice on your point, but is not guaranteed.
Right. Okay. Right.
So whether you're refusing because the 10 days have elapsed or you're refusing because the guy's name isn't in the record anymore becomes somewhat moot. McKaylee.
James Doc Rock coming your way. I think James might be referring to the registrant data and that stuff in the who is. I hope to God he doesn't mean the name servers.
No, of course. The context.
He doesn't.
No, but that needs to be made clear. Because the name servers are published in who is. And as James would know, in the case of some CCTLDs and even one GTLD, there are cases where the name servers are about the only bit of data that is actually there. So I think we need to be very careful that we're referring only to, I don't know what the clean way of wording it is. Somebody else might come up with something.
Again, we need words. Your point is very well taken.
Okay.
I don't think that was a rock. That was a clarification because it was the same problem with my original wording before James's suggestion. That's why they don't let any of us write policies all by ourselves. Any other comments on 4? Go on to 5. Now, this is one where I think it was Jeff said the language needs to be tightened up, and I don't think anyone will argue that language needs to be clarified. I'm not quite sure I know what tighten means.
Do you mind if I jump in?
Sure.
Let
me introduce it for those who
are. Sure, go ahead.
The intent of this one is any RAA provision cannot be ignored because we happen to be working through a reseller. And right now the RAA specifically says that certain provisions must be handled by the reseller and their display and something else, I don't remember what it is. This says that anything that's delegated to the reseller, someone must do it, either the registrar or the reseller. But the obligation cannot be removed simply because of the essentially subcontracting. And Jeff, you have the floor, and then James.
Okay, thanks. I actually have been thinking about this, and I was looking through some of the other pieces of the RAA, and I thought that maybe I'm off on this, but that this recommendation isn't needed. It's implicit in the current RAA, and that it's that saying that all the obligations that fall that falls upon the registrar, even if the reseller doesn't do it, it still falls upon the registrar. And that if we sort of start adding, what I'm worried about is if we start adding in every explicit item saying if this isn't covered, then the registrar does, then that sort of leads to loopholes down the line saying, oh, this wasn't covered, so now we have to state this. So I think the way it says it now, it's pretty clear or it's implicit that the registrar is responsible for all these functions. So, but I think maybe Marika or others might want to give some more color. But my thought is instead of tightening it up, we just get rid of this one.
Yeah, I can give the background, and but then we'll let James come in. In the original RAA, prior to this last change, it was completely silent. And my understanding of contract law is that you cannot, you know, you have to honor contract requirements regardless of who you subcontract to. Otherwise, everyone in the world would subcontract, and no clauses in contracts would have any meaning anymore. But the new RAA explicitly added it for two things. And it has been said that because that RAA did not include other things, that those weren't included. And so the recommendation here is not saying let's add a laundry list of other things, but simply making the global statement saying the registrar either must oblige the reseller doing it or the registrar must do it. But it can't fall between the cracks. So that was the intent. James?
Yep. I just wanted to support what Jeff was saying and also point out that this is meaningless for registrars. There are none on this call, but registrars who have not signed the new RAA.
Well, I don't think it's meaningless because...
if you're referring to them to 312.6, it does not exist in their RAA.
Okay. Good point.
So, I mean, you can't really hold them... I think the people...
No. The reference to the RAA here is not that clause. That's the reference that... Okay, you're right. The pointing to that number is not appropriate because it's not in the new RAA. There is an implicit statement. Tim was on the call. Is he still on?
I'm sorry, Alan, if I could clarify. It is in the new RAA. It's not in the old RAA.
Yes, correct. But the old one, I believe, had an implicit statement that the registrar is liable for all actions taken or not taken by their resellers.
Well, that's okay. And did we define reseller in the new RAA, or do we need a...
Yeah, the new one does define it.
Okay. Well, I'm going to go ahead and vote with Jeff on this one, that I think that, you know, if a reseller, sneezes and doesn't blow his nose, that we're responsible for that. I mean, that's just understood in this business, that we're responsible for what our resellers do. So I don't think calling that out in specific policies...
Then I guess I'd like to understand why the new one did feel it was necessary to call it out in certain specific areas. And I wasn't party to the discussions that created that language, so I don't know. Michele?
Right. Well, as the others have said, I mean, there is no 3.12.6 in the older version of the RAA.
Yeah, no, we agreed that's wrong.
Yeah, so, I mean, maybe the thing that, I mean, how do I word this? For any registrar on the 2009 RAA, this entire thing is pointless because we're already bound by it. If you're trying to get something into consensus policy, which would be binding on registrars on the older version of the RAA, then maybe okay. Personally, I wouldn't have an issue with this, but you'd have to remove the last sentence.
Yeah, no. Michele, I admit that last sentence shouldn't be there, and because it doesn't apply to the old RAA. It's wrong in that sense and needs to be fixed one way or another.
James come back. He might have a more intelligent comment than mine. Thanks.
Okay. James?
Oh, no one's ever accused me of that, but I just wanted to say that I want to throw a rock back at Michele and say that this is not okay if the intention is to bind someone to a newer version of a contract that they didn't sign. While it doesn't affect us in this particular case, it's easy to see how that could be used in the future to...
James, that wasn't what I was getting at at all.
On my part, there was no intent to do that. It was a mistake.
All right, then I'll drop it. And going down.
Well, I think if we remove the references to RAA here, so that I see exactly what James is getting at, and I can see exactly why that's a problem. I'm not sure what the best way of dealing with that is, because it would be unreasonable to start doing things like binding people to clauses and contracts that they weren't party to. So I'd actually side with James and Jeff and just remove the entire thing.
Well, I think there was an intent to fix a problem there, and I think we need to understand why the clause was added in the new RAA to understand what the problem.
It might be more of a perception than a reality.
Perhaps.
Because, I mean, the problem is this, Alan. Look, there's certain things where, you know, it's a... Like, in the last couple of years, the number of registrars that dropped quite a bit at one point, I mean, a lot of them didn't renew their accreditation or were in breach for a variety of reasons. I mean, there still is a very small percentage of registrars that are on the old RAA, but, I mean, they're pretty much outliers at this stage. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I can staff, but can probably speak to this better than I can.
Okay, let's put this one on hold. If nothing else, the language needs to be cleared up, and I think we need to. So at least I need some background that I don't have right now. So as it stands right now, I think we're going around in a circle. There's no question that there's no intent here to bind someone to an RAA they haven't signed. So may I suggest we put this one on hold and go on to the next one? All right. The new RAA includes a provision. I'm sorry, EDDP includes a provision that says you, the registrar, must post in various ways the price that they will charge for an RGP redemption. This is saying that they must do something similar for the price they charge post-expiration renewal. It doesn't put any limits on what the registrar, how the registrar sets that price, or if, as some registrars do, it's one price for the first 3 days and another price for the next N days. But it does say the price can't vary because of, you know, perceived value, you know, from pay-per-click or semantic analysis of the name, and it must be predictable ahead of time. Yes.
Okay. I had a major issue with this, not about the consistently of the pricing and what you were just saying about maybe raising it or lowering it. That's not the issue I have. It's about the reason why the information has to be posted on the registrar site is because if you operate through a reseller, the reseller is not able to offer the RGP. You need to go through the actual registrar. So what happens with this, you're saying the registrar has to put it on, and it doesn't explicitly say, you know, what the reseller needs to do, and each one handles it differently. So I'm not sure if putting it on the registrar's website makes any difference on this, because it's going to change completely if they operate exclusively through resellers. So that's the reason why it has to be on the RGP. It has to be in the agreement, because the RGP can only be done through the registrar, not through a reseller.
Okay, you're suggesting the different resellers may have different prices post-expiration.
Correct. I know that for a fact.
Okay. Now, what happens right now, when we talked about renewal post-expiration, and the question is, what happened if the reseller was not cooperating? And the universal answer we got was the registrar, even though they may not normally deal with resellers' customers, will step in and handle the transaction if necessary.
Yeah, we do that now. I'll tell you that.
How do you know what the price is at that point?
What the price is? We can see in our systems what the reseller charges. That's pretty simple.
Okay.
The
intent of this one, if you go into the rationale one, is that the registrant can look up right now, you know, it's like registering for a conference. If I register early, I get a certain price. If I register after a certain date, I get a different price. The intent here is the registrant can find out ahead of time what the redemption price is going to be, what the renewal price is going to be. If you can propose wording that has the same net effect.
Yeah, let me think about that, because what I'd like to – I think the idea is, correct me if I'm wrong, what you're worried about is – you register a domain name for, say, $14.99, and you don't see anywhere, you don't know that if you renew it on 5 days after expiration, it's going to be just $149.99 is what you're worried about, correct?
Yeah, that if you're going to do that, it should be posted.
Right, it should be posted.
And
okay.
What's more, the price can't vary based on you're looking at it and say, hey, you know, This is a marvelous name. I'm going to charge you more to renew because I know I can sell it on the open market for more.
What if I tell you that in advance?
If you tell me that in dollars, that's fine. If you simply say I'm going to assess the value and charge you an appropriate fee, no. The intent is you put a dollar number there or currency number.
Okay, I'm just curious about that. I just wanted to see about it. But let me think about the other piece, because it's, again, this is another one that gets. You know, the recommendations on here, from what it states and what the intention are two different things, and there's a lot of landmines around it. So
this is the downside of having resellers that ICANN doesn't know anything about. Michele.
Alan, yeah, I have a problem with this. The price charged for post-expiration during renewal must be explicitly stated in the registration agreement, blah, 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 blah. This price must also be provided at registration time and when pre- and post-expiration renewal notices are provided. There's a fundamental problem with that. if you were to register a .com today with me or with one of any of the other registrars, the price that we would charge and the renewal price that we would display would be based about in around whatever price we are being charged by the registry operator, which in the case of .com would be VeriSign.
Sure.
As most people on this call know, VeriSign and the other registry operators have been pushing their prices up at every opportunity that they're given. So the wholesale price that a registrar would pay for both registrations and renewals, exclusive of any other of any deals, discounts, promotions, or anything like that, has gone up. Others on this call probably could have tracked those prices more closely than I have. But there's no way for us to guarantee that if you register a domain name with Black Knight in 2011 for 8 or 10 years, that we are going to be able to offer the renewal price in 2020 or whatever.
Isn't that covered by the comment?
Alan?
Hello?
Hello?
Yeah. I'm still here.
The wording at the moment needs to capture that, because there's no way I could possibly agree to that recommendation in its current wording.
Well, I'm happy to have the wording change. I use the exact same wording as is used in the RAA regarding the RGP price. And again, that price may change over time. 10 years from now, it may be different.
Yeah, but the difference there is that the way the thing about the RGP is worded is that we are at all times to display the RGP price.
Right.
There's nothing stating that the RGP is going to be guaranteed to be the same in 2010 as it will be in 2020.
Yeah, and the intent is the same. If the wording that is in the recommendation now is not good, then we need better wording. The intent is not to try to lock you in to predicting a price 10 years out.
No, that's fair enough. No, it's just. But the problem that is that there have been cases where people have tried.
I have no doubt.
And don't forget, I've also been on the REA working groups as well.
Yeah.
And I've seen some of the.
Yeah. Your point is taken. The intent is that at any time when you send out a notice or you display a price, it's the then current price. It may change a day later. It may change 6 years later.
Yeah, I mean, it just has to be captured.
It may go down.
Yeah, right.
Oh, RGP prices did. If the words need to be changed, let's come up with better words. The intent is not to bind someone to a future price.
Okay.
James, is that a new hand?
It is indeed.
Okay, then you're on.
But I'll abbreviate and just say that, I pretty much agree with what Michele is saying. I think that the intent here is, my take on it was, not so much to constrain registrar pricing practices, because there are just way too many exigencies involved in those decisions, but to ensure that, you know, the registrant has some expectation of what certain services will charge, that there's a disclosure going on, and that there aren't any hidden surprises. So I think that if we can simplify this recommendation to saying that the registrants, the registrar and by extension the resellers, you know, will display these prices in their current registration agreement, which, you know, obviously it can also change during the course of the registration. You know, as long as those are there, it's not our responsibility to make sure that the registrar has read it or the registrant has, followed up with all those things. We're trying not to surprise them, but we can't be held responsible for, I think, all of the different ways that can break down.
So far we're violently agreeing with each other.
Okay.
And by the way, the words you just used may cover Jeff's original concern that it's hard to bind a registrar to things when there are resellers. The previous clause that we were discussing on that a reseller, a registrar must bind a reseller to do something if they don't. And this would fall into that category as far as I'm concerned, that if you deal through resellers, then that's simply one of the requirements you delegate to the reseller, and the reseller must. So I think that actually is addressed by the previous one. But the whole intent is that we restrict surprises to what are really surprises and not simply non-disclosures.
So let's, if I could suggest when we go through and tighten up this language, that we just focus on the disclosure requirements, what we want registrars to disclose, not what we want to happen to the price. Thanks.
I thought it said that already because we've already had this discussion, but if it doesn't, please suggest comments. Mason, you had your hand up and lowered it. You're yielding?
I'll yield on that. Yeah,
okay.
James captured it.
Again, if we're all violently agreeing, I hope that among us and ICANN's and ICANN staff, we can come up with wording that says what we all mean.
Well, if I may add, I would just underline what he said about disclosure versus really anything else. I mean, if the intention is to make clear to the registrant what to expect in terms just in terms of what to expect timing wise, that's fine. Specifying prices is not an ICANN function, so I want to stay away from that.
No, talking about is disclosure, not setting prices.
All right, good.
It restricts how you can set prices dynamically in the post expiration period. It is attempting to restrict that, but it's not attempting to say what the price is.
Okay, well, on that point, I want to be very careful about how we do that, because I don't think it's the intention of registrars to hold previous registrants hostage according to a perceived value of the name. But the registrars that have secondary market operations, that's a different story. So making those names available at market prices for new
What you do to the new buyer,
right?
Good luck to you. That's the business you're in. We're
right.
Talking about the renewal price to the original registrant.
Okay, well, as long as those prices aren't specified, because there are, as we've discussed, there are all sorts of fees that apply, and they change fairly often.
Yeah, and
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I think I tried to capture the intent there, and if I didn't do it well, then, as I said, I have a junior lawyer merit badge, but that's all.
Right,
and,
okay. Okay, well, I think we're just going to have to finesse the language then.
Yep.
All right.
All right, number 7, how are we doing on time? We have 25 minutes left to go, and we need some of that to discuss what we're doing in the future, so let's see how fast we can get through this. 7 says... Okay, that I think says if education material is made available and registrars are involved in the process, that it can be it should be pointed to. I think that's the one. Any problem with that? Again, in concept, wording may need to be fixed. Nothing? Okay. 22. This is suggesting that we change the term auto-renew grace period to something else, and I came up with an arbitrary set of words which may cover it. This has been reinforced by both users, registrants, being confused because of the two terms, and in fact, if you recall, when we did our original registrar survey at the beginning of this process, some registrars confused the two terms. And when we were talking about the auto-renew grace period, some registrars talked about their credit card renewal process with registrants. And so this is suggesting that in the documentation we change the name of one of them. And since from a consumer's point of view, an auto-renew thing where they leave their credit card I think is a reasonable name, I'm suggesting that we change the back-end one. James?
Not disagreeing that the terminology is confusing and we could probably make a change. I just want to point out that these terms are not just in policy, they're also expressed, I think, to some degree in the EPP protocol, or at least described in the RFC. So putting them out in the consensus policy that we want, you know, potato to be renamed to potato doesn't necessarily make it so. So just wanted to point that out. Thanks.
Point taken. Of course, what it says in the in protocols does not necessarily mean what we have to call it when we talk to registrants. So I suspect you're right technically. Nevertheless, we have the confusing terminology, and the question is, if we can't fix it this way, how can we fix it? Mace?
Yeah, same as James. I mean, I think, you know, much as it would be useful to clarify terms, I think we have to be careful about using the RAA or any existing agreement as the instrument to do that, because some of those terms probably in the agreement have legal meanings. Changing the terminology may change a legal meaning unintentionally. Then I would agree with the second part of your statement, which is, if not there, then what do we do to establish clarity? And that's a discussion I'm willing to have. We need to avoid using the RAA as the instrument of everything.
Well, we are asking for registry discussion on this, and I'm presuming that Marika is in discussion with ICANN compliance and ICANN legal. So if these are issues that need to be addressed, I have no fear they will bring one of those parties will bring it up. The intent is clarity to registrants, and I have no particular vested interest. I don't think any of us have a particular vested interest in what the methodology is if we can achieve the end. Further comments on 8? So that one clearly we have to make sure passes the sanity test from all parties. Nine is the recommendation that a neutral site be created to attempt to educate and provide information to registrants on how to take care of the care and feeding of their domain name, and a recommendation that at large should support that process to the extent possible in terms of contributing to the content or testing it or whatever is appropriate in that environment, and in creating public education if that kind of thing seems viable. Comments? No comments. Good. Or everyone dropped off the call. I still hear noise. James?
Just real quickly. I know we discussed this a little bit, and maybe it's a longer conversation, but, you know, we were having some discussions with compliance, both at the recent meeting in RT4 and I think in PEDNR and also in IRTP, and I think that there's some general misunderstandings or misconceptions about what ICANN does and what ICANN doesn't do, and maybe this site, when we talk about care and feeding of a domain name, also explains the role of the different organizations, registry, registrar, ICANN, et cetera. Just putting that out there, I don't know if it needs to be captured here. It's probably out of scope for this working group, but, you know, anything that we can do to cut down on the, let's call it customer service issues that seem to land on ICANN's lap would probably be a good benefit. This would be a good place, appropriate place to put those.
Well, I guess my personal feeling is if we do this kind of thing, and we being the, you know, you and us in terms of users and registrars, once it's there, I suspect it could be a home to a lot more than just the things we're talking about. And the overall tutorial on, you know, registrar versus registry and all the other things, I think are reasonable things to put there. A resource, if we can actually come up with it, I think will help all of us to a significant extent. McKaylee?
Just adding to what James is saying, I mean, it would also, you might find this amusing, but things like, you know, stating that neither the registrars, registries, or ICANN have any influence on search engines would be helpful, because I don't know, I can't speak for the other registrars, but I know that we get a stupid number of queries in relation to, well, Google, people's DSL connections, all sorts of crazy things that have absolutely nothing to do with the services that we offer. But more to the speaking more to the, this recommendation, are you registrar? I mean, which registrar? I mean, who, where, how is this going to be decided?
I use the exact wording that James put in the recommendation. I wasn't foolish enough to change it. I don't know that, the answer to that.
James.
Whoa, what?
It is a best practice, so we're not committing anyone to it.
Yeah, I don't remember this. I mean, I remember talking about this concept. I don't remember writing this language, I should say.
I'm afraid you did, sir.
Well, I don't use words like steward. But anyway,
you subcontracted the writing to someone else.
Yeah. I think that we discussed this during the Registrar AWAC meeting in Cartagena, where we discussed how this might look and how it might operate. I don't recall the language itself, but I will take another look.
This came out at the same time in the same email that you sent the proposal for the 5-day period, if you recall those painful days.
I will go back and review my notes, sir.
Yeah. By the way, it's not only registrars and other people who want things. I suspect senior ICANN people would like to see a statement there saying they're not the ones who take down WikiLeaks domains.
Right, well, it is an important matter, Alan, because I mean it's, you know, you see the thing is, I mean, you do see people, you know, picking up the completely wrong end of the stick, which causes customer service issues for ICANN, for the registries, for the registrars, for everybody, and it just causes a massive headache for everybody.
Hey, you're not going to find me arguing it. I don't understand how we've gotten to 2011 and we don't have such a site somewhere. But
true.
we are here. So if we're the instrument that causes it to come into existence, we've earned our keep for the week.
Related to this, is it my understanding that ALAC at present is preparing some of its budget submissions? Would that be correct?
You mean the budget submissions, which in all previous years have been completely ignored? Yes.
Well, yeah, those. has anything in relation to this been considered for inclusion?
I haven't been paying attention to it since I'm not on ALAC anymore. Maybe Cheryl can make a comment. Is there something that could be construed as including this?
He has his hand up.
I believe the answer is yes, but I'm not sure.
He is the man.
Yeah, hi. I'd love to be able to answer you, but we're only actually going to get all of the input from the RALOs tomorrow. So we're just 24 hours ahead of knowing. But we will get back to you on that. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, Olivier, as I'm not associated with any of them, but I think, you obviously are, and Cheryl... I assume is. The thing is that there's been several working groups where there's been suggestions about, you know, these kind of initiatives and everything else. And I would just hope that you would capture this, because otherwise, you know, a discussion will be held again in another 12 to 18 months, and, you know, you'd be asking registrars to do certain things, and the question we'll be asking is, well, hold on, you know, you guys had the opportunity to do something about this. We didn't see you doing it.
Yeah. Michele, if I remember correctly from the original proposal, the budget issue was not so much in creating this resource, which it was volunteered that registrars would do that themselves, but in an education campaign in using material. And I suspect, if we look at the timing, that probably will not kick in this fiscal year, but perhaps the next one. just looking at the time it will take to actually get this kind of thing in place. So it may not be an issue that this fiscal year needs to cover it, but again, I'm speaking out of my realm of actual knowledge. But the intent when it was originally proposed is not that the ALAC create this, but the ALAC use it in education programs or things like that as appropriate afterwards.
If I may just add a couple of things, Alan?
Yeah.
Thank you, Alan.
I hadn't realized you were on the call. That's why I said Cheryl.
Oh, well, I think both of us are on the call. Both of us
indeed,
are
but
quite
I
a few hours
I
today. So
I hadn't actually seen your name.
Okay. Yes, with regards to education material, that's definitely something which at large is working on. And thankfully, we appear to be getting a more positive ear from those in power at ICANN with regards to coming out with material that will be used by people who are foreign to ICANN and who do not know about ICANN. We have been in great discussions with Scott Pinson, and there's definitely some movement going on that. And this is actually taking place outside any type of budget that at large would have to bid for. So it's in addition to the budget, because it's something that would benefit all of ICANN, not only at large. Thank you.
Thank you, Olivier. All right, number 10. This is the one that we had extensive discussions on methods of delivering notices, and we pretty much unilaterally or unanimously recognized that there's no way we can specify what methodology be used, but that the information presented to registrants should give them advance notice of what will be used, or at least the base set of what will be used, so that they know where to look for messages, and they can't claim, you know, that they weren't expecting anything at all through that type of method, whether it's email or something else. Any questions on this or comments? Again, not setting what registrars do, just that they notify their customers of what general methodology they'll be using. McKaylee.
So just if I get you right, you're saying that we don't how do I phrase this? That okay. I suppose the problem I have with this wording is that I can see this being interpreted in an overly narrow sense, in that if I were to say that we will do X or do X, and then, I don't know, some new technology came along, or maybe email became defunct and Zuckerberg's dream became reality and we all started using Facebook. you know, if it's worded too narrowly, then that would mean that even though email was defunct, we would still be forced to use it, and we wouldn't be able to use this new Facebook messaging thing, which has replaced the SMTP protocol. So I suppose that what I've been looking for here is some way. I mean, I understand the rationale side of it, but the flip side to it as well is that, you know, you're talking about a policy, you're not talking about a best practice. So when you're mandating policy, you know, if as a registrar I breach policy, I'm putting my contract at risk. So I'm just very wary about how that is worded so that we don't end up kind of backing ourselves into a corner, which won't help us and won't help you.
Yeah, the intent is that you're currently sending email to the administrative contact listed on WHOIS, then say so. If you change it tomorrow that from now on you're using the the Facebook best friend contact that everyone has had to put into their registration record, then you change your registration agreement to say that. It's no different than changing any other term in the registration agreement. It's just that, I mean, and that's the kind of example. Right now, typically a registration agreement does not say who you send it to. You may send it to all of the contacts. You may send it to one of them. I don't know which one. You know, so even in the email case, there's no predictability right now. And this is simply saying, tell the registrant what you plan to do. If you plan to, if you change it, you change it. It's always the then current. And there are rules in the RAA already on what you have to do if you change the registration agreement in substantive ways.
As long as we can change us, then that's fine. I have this fear of the kind of what we're going to do in 2011 is what we're going to do in 2020.
No, that's we're all going to be dead by then anyway, so it doesn't matter. But that's a joke. Okay, no, there's certainly no intent there, and if the wording indicates that, then we need to fix the wording. And again, we're going to have to call it quits. I think we better stop right now because we have 7 more minutes. And Mariko, we discussed some things we need to decide, and I forget what they are now. Do you remember?
This is Mariko. I think we need to decide on how to call on the recommendations, and another point will be whether we need additional meetings, taking into account that the publication deadline, if we will continue on the current schedule, is 3 meetings away.
All right. So let's do the polling first. We have basically 2 choices. We can set up a poll, which is a board by some, but the working group rules specify that we cannot make consensus calls purely on who is on a call at any given time, that we must include the full working group, including those who do not participate in the calls. And typically what groups have done is hold a poll for that. The other alternative is use a mailing list and, essentially ask for the poll responses on the mailing list. And typically what people do is, if request that anyone who disagrees identify themselves, otherwise that they are deemed to have agreed. I can certainly live with both. The email one is a lot easier. Any thoughts on this? Leave it up to Marika and me, or you can speak up as to which you prefer. No speaking up. Okay, Marika and I, and you and I will make a recommendation, and if anyone strongly objects once we make it, they can say so at that point.
Hello, this is Ron. I don't have the W Connect to raise my hand. Yes. Okay, I have a question now that we're looking at the final report. The participants, some of whom do not participate but are listed, I'm wondering who the is there a list? Is there a current list that I can see that indicates all of those that would be counted in a consensus, even if they haven't participated?
I believe it's basically the people who are in that list, although there have been a few added. The working group, the group that established working group rules, which apply to the, it's not clear how they apply to us because we're in a transition. But assuming that we are taking the rules as the ones that we are using, explicitly says that we cannot just do a consensus call on a conference call, that it must include people who are on the mailing list and presumably read the mails and comment if they wish and read the documents. There has been no litmus test of how much do you have to participate in which ways to be counted as a valid participant. So I think we're stuck with essentially the people on the mailing list are the definitive group. If we do a poll, and the argument for a poll is you count the people who answered. If they didn't answer the poll yes or no, then they don't exist. Those who cared enough answered the poll. So that's the pro for the poll. We know what the baseline is of the total number of participants in the poll, whereas there may be people on the mailing list who are, exist in some level, but I think that's one of the factors that, that comes into the decision of how to do it.
Okay, thank you.
All right, we have six meetings. We have three more weeks to go before we are supposed to have essentially a final report rolled out ready for publication. And our intent has been to publish and hold a session in San Francisco and presumably open up for public comments, I'm guessing afterwards, with the target of getting a final report produced soon after that and going back to council. If we are still aiming at that target, and none of us, I think, want to continue to have this drag out a lot more than that, do we feel that we can do this in three more meetings and whatever work we do in between meetings, or do we need to, as some other groups have done, schedule a second meeting a week with the intent of only using it if we have substantive work to do? And that would put the second meeting of the week probably on Thursday or Friday in our case. Fridays tend to be moderately empty and are admittedly on Saturday for a few people on this group. And Marika says she cannot do Fridays because she doesn't work Fridays, so Thursdays it would be. Are people agreeable to a doodle to try to find a time on Thursday? Thursdays are bad days in general. Michaela also doesn't do Fridays. I want one of those jobs, too. Touché, Michaela. A doodle for Thursdays? I see no negatives, so we'll have that done right after this meeting. And hopefully, if we're efficient and use the mailing list in between, then we can hold those to a minimum and not need them. I think we're done for the day. I thank you all. Marika and I will get out a revision of these recommendations, factoring in what was said today in the next day or so. And please read them and comment on them, either in email or modifying the documents, whichever way you feel is appropriate, because we really need to try to get this work done between meetings. We're not going to succeed in purely having discussions on the meetings. I thank you all for your cooperation. We are making progress. We may see the light at the end. The light at the end of the tunnel may, in fact, be something we see, and hopefully it's not a train rushing at us. I thank you for your time, and we'll talk to you later.
Bye, Solomon.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Yeah, bye, Al.
Thanks, Alan.
Thanks. Bye.